Good evening. Good evening. My name is Paul Holdengraber, and I'm the Director of Public Programs here at the New York Public Library, otherwise known as LIVE from the New York Public Library. As you know, I've said this 100 times, my goal at the library is simply to make the lions roar, to make a heavy institution dance, and when I'm successful, to make it levitate. It was a pleasure to show you Patti Smith, to give you a sense. I think it was appropriate in so many different ways to show that video in particular with New York, a bygone New York, and to invite to the stage in a minute from now Paul Auster. I would like to also encourage you all after the event to have your book signed by Paul Auster. A Winter Journal is a book that we will be discussing tonight among many other of Paul Auster's works. I also encourage you to become a member of the New York Public Library, to support it, to support our great collection and everything we do for you, and to come to many of the events that are coming up now. Tomorrow I'll be interviewing Cheryl Strayed, then we will be having Stephen Johnson and Sherry Turkle, after that Pete Townsend on Monday, and Katie Royfe on Wednesday, and many, many more other events. You'll have them all on your seat. Now, it is my great, great pleasure to invite to the stage Paul Auster. And as you know, I've always asked, or I've asked for the last 4 or 5 years, the various guests to give me a biography of themselves in 7 words, a haiku of sort, or if you're extremely modern, a tweet. Usually, I know these 7 words in advance. When I asked Paul Auster for his 7 words, he kept them close to himself, and he will let us know what the 7 words are that define or don't define him. Please welcome Paul Auster.
It's not usual that a writer is asked to introduce himself, but this is what Paul asked of me in only 7 words. So this is what I came up with. American, New Yorker, wanderer, husband, father, writer, troublemaker.
Which of those words do you feel is the least important?
They're all important.
Troublemaker?
Very important, yes.
How so?
How so? Because the idea when I was a young person, I mean, watching Patti Smith there, she's a bit older than I am, but we're certainly from the same generation. The idea of being an artist when I was young, when she was young, was to break the mold, not to fit into conventions, not to do what people had done before you. And this has been a guiding light throughout my entire life as a writer. And politically, I want to be a troublemaker. Artistically, I want to be a troublemaker. So it's essential. Wanderer is also essential. I've been all over the place, even though this is the center for me, New York City. I've been all over the world, and somehow that has defined me as well. What am I going to eliminate? Husband? No. Father? No. So everything is essential.
Is it harder to be a troublemaker now?
Not really, if you put your mind to it.
Wanderer? Harder to be a wanderer now that most places have been discovered?
No, you can still go anywhere you want. In fact, I think it's probably easier to be a wanderer now than it used to be. And I can't imagine what my life would have been if I had just stayed here all my life. I think the adventures of living abroad, being in other cultures, have informed who I am and made me better and a more alert and more interested person about the world.
And in many ways, we'll get to this in a moment, in many ways, this book, Winter's Journal, is in effect the book of a wanderer. A wanderer as he takes on a journey his own body.
Well, wandering is part of the book, but then there's a lot of just immobility as well, because I think what's interested me always is the two. The man alone in a room, the thinking individual, the solitary soul, indifferent to surroundings, finding some kind of inner essence. At the same time, counterbalanced by a freedom to go wherever the body wants to take you. And in some sense, then the physical journeys become a mirror of the mental journeys that you conduct in absolute stasis and silence and solitude.
The first sentence of Winter Journal is, "You think it will never happen to you, that it cannot happen to you, that you are the only person in the world to whom none of these things will ever happen." And then, one by one, they all begin to happen to you in the same way they happen to everyone else. I'd like you to talk about this first sentence and also this very strong use of the word "you."
The second person is a very unusual way to write a book. I know of a number of novels that have been written that way, but not many, just a handful. I can't think of a single autobiographical work that has been written in the second person. And I'll tell you why I did it. It came instinctively, and I didn't question it. I started writing this way, but then as I got into the project, because when you start a book, you don't know if it's going to become a book. You're just feeling your way through. But once I understood that it was going to be something that I could finish, I stopped and examined what I was doing, and I thought, well, the reason I'm writing about myself is not to tell the story of my life, which is finally quite uninteresting, I think. It's an attempt to try to communicate what it feels like to be alive in one's own body, something we all share, something that is
something what it means. Infinitely personal and universal.
And universal. So therefore, the I, which is the typical person of an autobiographical work, I felt would have been too exclusionary. I didn't want to just tell my own story. There is a possibility of a he, which I've used in a previous autobiographical work, the second half of The Invention of Solitude, which is also an option, and I know several autobiographical works that use the he.
Most recently we had on this stage Salman Rushdie, whose whole book is written.
That's right, Salman's new book, but then J.M. Coetzee's three autobiographical works are all in the third person as well. So there are many ways to do this, but I thought in this case the third person would have been too distancing. Therefore, I'm left with the second person. So what does the second person give me?
You're left with it.
Well, it's the only other option. A kind of intimacy, but at the same time, a distance, as if addressing myself, and therefore able to enter into a dialogue with myself.
So it isn't solipsistic.
Not at all. And the distance, that displacement from the I to the you, I hope allows the reader to enter the book in a very full way.
Well, you know, it is as if you're reenacting, using that you, the notion of the reader as being, the person who reads the book as being the reader of his own life in reading this book. It's as if the scars you describe on your face, the urge you have at certain moments to go to a restroom, all these various moments you describe of bodily function and of a body in pain is something that a reader, upon reading it, can he or she feel themselves as if they were going to a mirror to look at what their face looked at that moment.
I would assume so. I mean, we've all been through these things. And much of what I write about in this book is what people don't talk about. But I wanted to talk about the things that are not discussed openly. Because this is also what it means to be alive. And I'm very interested in trying to communicate this. Bring it to life on the page. Just breathing in your own body, just walking down the street, feeling, you know, sleet lashing your face, whatever it might be that you're going through. We're always living in a completely physical environment. Modern life has protected us from many of these things, but not all by any means, and we're still subject to bumps and bruises and knocks and accidents and the unexpected charging in on us at every moment, and therefore, again, accidents are part of this book as well, and everything that is unpredictable.
I like that words of the used bumps. Well, because in a way, this book is about bumping.
Probably you're right. I mean, when American children were little, in my day, when you crashed into something, your mother would say, "Oh, you've got a bump, right? You've bumped. You have a bump on your head. You've bumped into something." And we're constantly bumping into things, even as grown-ups.
Bumping into people, bumping, hurting ourselves.
Hurting ourselves.
You describe with a certain amount of intimacy and intricacy the various ways in which you nearly avoided disaster and sometimes didn't avoid it at all. As, for instance, when you describe your face, which could be a moment in the book that is nearly like an autobiography of the face.
Well, I begin small in the book, and then I get into bigger things. I have had scars. I think everyone has scars of one kind or another. You know, the one here, and the one here, and the one here, and the one here. And these are just normal incidents in the course of a life. Nobody gets through life unscathed physically. And if we're not banging into things, and we're not falling off of buildings and crashing our cars into other cars, then there can be internal illnesses. All kinds of things are happening to us. And we're always negotiating a way to try to stay on top of the things that could do us in or are going to at least diminish our lives. And we keep forging on.
You are kind of amazed at moments that we don't hurt ourselves more often, that we don't bump into more things. There are so many close calls.
But I think anyone who gets to be a certain age has been through X number of close calls. You cannot get through a human life untouched by life. It's just impossible. This is, I think, maybe the final message of this book, is that we're all part of it. And
the first sentence,
yes,
says that.
Yes, but it's
we're
all
porous in some way.
We're all having the same experiences in different variations of that experience.
And so it's nearly miraculous that we manage.
Yes, and all those who don't manage. Think of how many people we know who have died in accidents during the course of our lives. The unlucky ones, the ones who don't get through the scrapes, who die in a car crash at 17 and don't make it to be 60 years old. We know many of these people. We all know them. It's part of our, everyone's past. It's the disease and the accidents and the unforeseen that will rob us of the lives of people we care about.
I'd like you to read a passage about scars.
Ah, he's picked this all. You know, we haven't discussed what we're going to do.
Isn't that so much better?
Yeah. All right. Give it to me and I'll read it.
Which so one? From here to here.
All right. Okay. This is on page 5, so we're very early in the book.
There'll be later pages.
I see the thing. The inventory of your scars, in particular the ones on your face, which are visible to you each morning when you look into the bathroom mirror to shave or comb your hair. You seldom think about them, but whenever you do, you understand that they are marks of life, that the assorted jagged lines etched into the skin of your face are letters from the secret alphabet that tells the story of who you are. For each scar is the trace of a healed wound, and each wound was caused by an unexpected collision with the world. That is to say, an accident, or something that need not have happened. Since by definition, an accident is something that need not happen. Contingent facts as opposed to necessary facts. And the realization as you look into the mirror this morning that all life is contingent, except for the one necessary fact that sooner or later it will come to an end. Then there's a break. So this is the account of the first scar. You are 3 1/2, and your 25-year-old pregnant mother has taken you along with her on a shopping expedition to a department store in downtown Newark. She is accompanied by a friend of hers, the mother of a boy who is 3 1/2 as well. At some point, you and your little comrade break away from your mother's and begin running through the store. It is an enormous open space, no doubt the largest room you have ever set foot in. And there is a palpable thrill in being able to run wild through this gargantuan indoor arena. Eventually, you and the boy begin belly flopping onto the floor and sliding along the smooth surface, sledding without sleds, as it were. And this game proves to be so enjoyable, so ecstatic in the pleasure it produces, that you become more and more reckless, more and more daring in what you are willing to attempt. You reach a part of the store where construction work or repair work is underway. And without bothering to take notice of what obstacles might lie ahead, you belly flop onto the floor again and sail along the glass-like surface until you find yourself speeding straight toward a wooden carpenter's bench. With a small twist of your small body, you think you can avoid crashing into the leg of the table that is looming before you. But what you do not realize in the split second you have to shift course is that a nail is jutting from the leg, a long nail low enough to be at the level of your face. And before you can stop yourself, your left cheek is pierced by the nail as you go flying past it. Half your face is torn apart. 60 years later, you have no memories of the accident. You remember the running and the belly flopping, but nothing about the pain, nothing about the blood, and nothing about being rushed to the hospital or the doctor who sewed up your cheek. He did a brilliant job, your mother always said. And since the trauma of seeing her firstborn with half his face ripped off never left her, she said it often. Something to do with a subtle double stitching method that kept the damage to a minimum and prevented you from being disfigured for life. You could have lost your eye, she would say to you, or even more dramatically, you could have been killed. No doubt she was right. The scar has grown fainter and fainter as the years have passed, but it is still there whenever you look for it. And you will carry that emblem of good fortune, eye intact, not dead, until you go to your grave.
Thank you so much. So many questions, but one comment is you really make us feel that moment, reenact that moment of a close call, the danger, and the nail going through your face. You set it up as if there was a plot that will hurt, a moment that will scar.
Well, we've started with scars, so we're already anticipating what the wound is going to be that will cause the scar, yes.
but also the memory.
It's very dim, I have to say, but I do remember belly flopping. I do remember that. Unless I'm making it up. Because we know that memory is a very deceptive thing, and that sometimes we think we remember things that we don't really remember, things that people have told us, and then we suddenly imagine and then incorporate into our bodies, really. But I do feel that I remember the belly flopping, but I can't be certain. And there's no way that we can verify this one way or the other.
We can verify the scar.
The scar, yeah, is right here. It's very, very faint now. But through most of my childhood, it was quite visible.
And it's something you bring up also in the invention of solitude, which in so many ways, I think, plays strongly as an echo chamber to this particular book, of not all the moments we do not remember, the moments, the early moments you spend with your son when he was two or three. This is a moment that I must say, as I started to have children, and even before that, I was thinking about so much of the time we spend that we are actively spending, but the younger self, the younger child, has no memory of.
No.
None at all.
Obliterated completely. We don't really have a continuous narrative memory until we're about five. I think most of us have memories from late three, four, but they're very isolated, and they're not part of any continuous story. But five and a half, I think we reach a moment when we can start telling ourselves the story of our own life. We feel that we're living in an inner narrative. But before then, the material is lost or very, very fragmentary and slight.
The belly flop, you think you remember, why?
I don't know why. I'm sure it's a physical sensation that is part of my motor neuronal system, and it's connected to my memory, and it's still there. But again, I'm not going to guarantee that this is an authentic memory. What I do have is my mother's account of what happens. And I'm sure she was completely accurate about the events of that day.
I'd like us to look at... well, first of all, I should say that your archives are here at the New York Public Library. And we're privileged to have Isaac Gurwitz here, who's the curator of the Berg Collection, and who has made available to us some of the materials from this collection. What does it feel like to be classified here?
It's a very strange experience, I have to say. I threw out a lot of material, and I started writing very early, I should say. 15, 16, I was serious about writing and felt that this was going to be my destiny. So we're talking about almost 50 years. I'm 65 now, so close to 50 years I've been doing this. Well, as one writes, one tears up pieces of paper, throws them away. But then there's the other material one keeps, and one becomes reluctant to throw out things, and I, for some reason, kept a lot of youthful writings, which never amounted to much in themselves, but served as the basis for works that I later was able to finish, that would return to and then complete it. The library has a lot of that material. On the one hand, I think, well, what's the point? The only thing that matters are the finished books. This is, you know, what people care about, what people read. On the other hand, we were here early, and Isaac gave us a tour of the Berg Collection, bringing out some wonderful things. And there was, William Blake's illuminated texts. And there was Nabokov marking up his copy of Bleak House, no doubt to teach a class on it, and also marking up his copy of Kafka's The Metamorphosis in a kind of outrage, retranslating the text. So if you're interested in Dickens or if you're interested in Nabokov, this becomes very passionate stuff. And I think these archives are very important to helping us understand the process of creating literature better. Whether I deserve to be here or not is another question. But I feel very grateful that my papers are here.
But Paul, here you are.
Here I am.
Here.
And upstairs.
Yes.
Here, yeah.
And here you are, and my question is perhaps slightly more pointed, which is, what does it mean for you? I mean, what are some of the feelings you might have seeing your own work here and being able to rummage through it, have others rummage through
it? I'll tell you, one of the really big reasons why I did this, and I started giving papers here 20 years ago, it was because after I'd written and published a certain number of novels, there were academics who were writing about them. And I was getting letters all the time, and trying to answer people. And I really didn't want to do this, because a writer never wants to look back. You're always looking to today and tomorrow, but yesterday is of no importance. So by giving my papers here, all I had to do was say to people, go to the Berg Collection at the New York Public Library. It just relieved me of a tremendous burden. And so I'm very grateful, Isaac. Thank you. Yeah.
Let me ask you though one more time, if I may. For you to see these various manuscripts, have they been actually helpful?
Helpful
in writing a Winter's Journal.
No, I wasn't looking at these manuscripts.
At all?
No.
You remembered everything, whether real or false, on your own without...
Well, you see, I never kept diary or journal, so there's no source of the material that's in this book that is written anywhere. No, what's in the library here are drafts of pieces.
We'll look at one. Yeah. If we could look at the image number one.
Let's see. I have a little screen here, too.
You might not be. It's just this passage, which ends up...
Which
is crossed off and ends up not being part of The Invention of Solitude. It's such an interesting passage, and I looked in the original, and indeed it isn't there.
Well, you know, one is cutting things out all the time, and as I glance at this... And this is a late version of the book, because I don't type until later. Mostly I'm writing by hand in notebooks. So if I cross this out, I must have felt that it was redundant, that I had already said this elsewhere in a different way.
And you speak about typing and the tactility of typing as a
yes.
way of rereading yourself with great care. But still, you didn't feel it was totally redundant, because you added a little...
Well, I guess when you see the handwritten material, it's when I thought I was going to keep this, so I made a little change, and then I realized, finally, cut the whole thing. So, you know, one is doing this all the time.
It's an interesting passage.
Yeah. Well, it's about Jonah and the whale. There's a long meditation on this.
Do you mind reading those five lines that you cut out?
Oh, well, all right. You know, this is, we're talking about something that was written in 1979 or 80. For a man who is destined to speak, silence stands as an image of the solitude that precedes the act of speech. Even alone in the silence of his room, this is the third
yeah.
person that we were talking about. Even alone in the silence of his room and the four walls that enclose him on himself, he is only to speak to find the other who lives inside him. At the moment he speaks, he discovers he is two. That is to say, the one who speaks and the one who hears what is spoken. For even when there is no answer, it cannot be said that the voice that speaks is heard by no one, even when no one else is there. Well, that's kind of interesting.
Isn't it about what happens when you're writing.
I mean, yes.
I'm not trying just to, you know,
no.
make you suffer. I mean, this is interesting. Why is it kind of interesting for you?
Well, I guess it's interesting because it is about what happens when you're writing. Because obviously when you're writing, you're reading what you write. And so the writer and the reader are somehow two parts of yourself. It's not the same being that's doing the writing and then reading over what you've written. And this is an attempt to explain that. And probably, I thought, this is so subtle and unimportant to the general drift of what I was trying to say that I cut it out for that reason. Because, you see, in writing, the goal is not to write beautiful things, not even elegant things. No, the goal is to say something meaningful, something that burns through literature, life, and everything, and gives you some feeling that you're confronting something essential about what it means to be alive. I keep coming back to this, but this has been my whole motive as a writer for all these years. And therefore, this was not doing the job. I was digressing. In a book full of digressions, it was one digression too many.
Too many.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I know that you fancy Rimbaud's comment, je est un autre.
Yes.
The I is another. And in reading this particular book, A Winter's Journal, I felt that the inspiration was not just Rimbaud and the dissociation of the you to the other you writing, or to the you that is looking back at the former self. But one of the inspirations struck me as being Montaigne, and the Montaigne of the essays, the Montaigne who says that when we read, we are a reader of our own self.
Well, Montaigne is an enormously important writer for me. And I started reading him young when I was an undergraduate at Columbia, and I started in 1965. My first French teacher was Donald Frame, who was the translator and biographer of Montaigne, and no one has surpassed Frame's translations of Montaigne, I must say. So by my sophomore year, I was in the Montaigne seminar with Donald Frame, 10 boys, one of them being Mark Rudd, if anyone knows who that was, the SDS leader who led the revolution at Columbia in 68. There we were reading Montaigne in French in the original, the Pléiade edition of Montaigne. And it was an entire semester of immersion. I think in this very library, there are two or three papers I wrote on Montaigne for that class. It had such an impact on me. And Montaigne was the first person in Western history to write about himself as a fit subject. In a non-religious sense. We have St. Augustine doing his confessions in around the year 400, but this is all in relation to religious belief. Montaigne, no, this is entirely secular project, thinking that this studying a man himself was a fit subject for men to study. And this was a revolutionary jump. Also, there's the thing about Montaigne's prose, which is about the most extraordinary prose one could ever read, because it's a very energetic and unencumbered prose of propulsion. And he works with parataxis, which is stringing sentences along, just putting and, so that there is not this elaborate rhetoric that one would find in the 16th century, but something much more immediate and, I would dare say, contemporary, something very compatible to the way we approach things. And this man was so far ahead of his time that whenever anyone talks about the essay and autobiographical writing, he is the prime reference. And I was not immune to the beauties and power of this writer and made an enormous impression on
him. And the essay, quite literally, is an attempt.
That's the literal translation of it. Yeah.
And it's also an assay, which means simply to weigh. But also in the act of essaying, in the act of trying out, it is not unlike, I think, what you're doing in this most recent book, an attempt at self-discovery.
Well, if there's any literary antecedent for Winter Journal, it would be Montaigne. For sure. He's the first one who's pointed this out, by the way.
It's not a bad genealogy.
No. But I've been reading him and reading him all my life. And,
but it is, you know, I mean it also quite seriously, because you read the passage about the scar. The book is an attempt to put up a mirror.
A mirror to whom?
To yourself and surroundings, but to yourself. You are looking at a six-year-old boy. You're looking at a 15-year-old boy. And you're looking at that boy as he ages. And as age transforms and changes him, and as he arrives at a certain station in life. And you're looking at him quite often with distance, and sometimes the you becomes an accusation, sometimes the you becomes an address to. And I think in that way, there is, Montaigne is
yes,
there.
I think maybe that distance of the you can also create a certain kind of humor and jocularity that I have striven for in this book, too. It's not a heavy book.
Really?
But it's not a light book, either.
Well,
it's both.
Yeah.
It's both. It's about pleasure and pain.
Yeah.
It's about both. It's about
the pleasures of somersaults,
yes,
and the pain of the nail.
That's right. That's right.
It's about the difficulty of being in the back seat. I mean, that passage is fantastic.
When I have to pee when I'm five
years
old?
Yeah, do you know where it is?
Yeah, I'll find it. It's
I mean,
probably
this is a passage. You see, we really hadn't prepared this.
Oh, I opened right onto the...
Did you?
Yes, this is, this is funny.
What is that phenomenon, by the way, of opening one's book at a certain page? This happens to me quite often.
It's
where
called
you
the Holden Graber phenomenon,
okay.
I guess. Yes. So here's page 17. Again, it is 1952, and you're in the back seat of the family car. The blue 1950 DeSoto your father brought home the day your sister was born. Your mother is driving, and you have been on the road for some time now, going from where to where you can no longer remember. But you are on your way back, no more than 10 or 15 minutes from home, and for the past little while, you have had to pee. The pressure in your bladder has been building steadily, and by now you are writhing on the back seat, legs crossed, your hand clamped over your crotch, uncertain whether you could hold out much longer. Now, this is funny to me. I'm sorry. This is not heavy stuff. Your mother, you tell your mother about your predicament, and she asks you if you could hang in there for another 10 minutes. No, you tell her, you don't think so. In that case, she says, since there's nowhere to stop between here and home, just go in your pants. This is such a radical idea to you, such a betrayal of what you consider to be your hard-won, manly independence, that you can scarcely believe what she has said. Go in my pants, you say to her? Yes, go in your pants, she says. What difference does it make? We'll throw your clothes in the wash the minute we get home. And so it happens, with your mother's full and explicit approval, that you pee in your pants for the last time.
It's a fantastic. It is very funny.
It is funny. Yes.
But it's funny, and what your language manages to do there is to embody the body.
Well, let's hope so. That's
That's do you remember? Effort. Do you remember that moment?
I do.
Clearly?
That I mean, I was five. I remember that well. Listen, we've all been there. We've all been in tight squeezes, but no one ever writes about this. And so I thought,
God damn it, I will.
I had to write about it. Yes.
you know, this brings back to mind another writer who, Montaigne on the one hand, and then a French writer who I much admire named Georges Perec, who, like you, writes extraordinary lists and writes extraordinary pages about where he is in the world. And he called this phenomenon l'infraordinaire, what is beneath the ordinary, what is so important and goes unnoticed.
Well, Perec, I don't know. Most Americans don't know who Perec
and
was.
And Species of Spaces is fantastic.
He's a great writer. He died. He's a contemporary writer. He was born in 1936, and I think it was 36.
That's right.
And he died in 82. He was only 46 when he died. It was a life cut off way too soon. But he was truly brilliant. He wrote novels, he wrote essays, he wrote journalism, all kinds of things. He worked for the radio. One of my favorite little pieces by Perec is, one year he decided to catalog everything he ate and drank. It's a three-page essay. You know, 42 hamburgers, you know, 67 glasses of cognac. And it's just the whole year.
But you do something very similar. You ask yourself in the book, how many times have I swallowed such and such a drink?
Yes, but I haven't counted them. He counted them. I asked myself how many.
So he's more obsessive.
Much more obsessive. Look, the list goes all the way back. Rabelais was doing lists, and it's part of literature. James Joyce was a great list maker as well. And Beckett, Swift, many writers have done lists.
You know, two of my favorite Perec stories are Perec sitting at the Café de la Mairie in Paris on the Place Saint-Sulpice. And he's sitting there, and he's going to sit there for a few hours and write down everything he sees. And it's called Tentative d'épuisement d'un lieu parisien, the attempt to exhaust a French space.
That's right.
And a pigeon poos, and a tram passes, and a person loses his hat. And the book is phenomenally interesting and atrociously boring in some
way. I think he did this. He did something similar, or maybe it's the same project, as a radio broadcast, too. He was sitting there, and he's just describing everything he can see.
But you know, one other project that I don't know if you know about, which to my mind seems very, very Paul Auster-ish, is he was going to do it for 12 years, but I think he only did it for 5 or 6, which was he was going to write the story of his street.
Yeah.
And he was going to catalog everything on a certain day in the street once a year, everything that was happening in the street. And then...
Well, I'm looking at...
And he stops. I wonder if it might be one of the pages I
well,
and
now that you're mentioning this...
No, and what he does is he... what he wants to see, and he'll put it in a sealed envelope, and he will look at how he describes the street, the strengths of his memory, and how the city of Paris is changing. So three, it's an attempt at seeing what happens to language through time. What are you looking for?
I'm looking in my collected prose, a little piece I wrote in 2001. So, and I was asked by Perec's widow to do this. And the Bibliothèque Nationale, another great library, the French National Library, has Perec's papers, and they were doing a bulletin about him, and they were asking for pieces, and his widow asked me to do this, and so I'm going to read this.
Please.
It's a little appreciation of Perec, and it's entitled Postcards for Georges Perec. 1. Whenever I think about Georges Perec, the first word that comes to mind is pleasure. I know of no other contemporary writer whose work so fully captures the sense of amazement and happiness that washes over us the first time we read a book that changes the world for us. that exposes us to the infinite possibilities of what a book can be. Every passionate reader has had that experience. It usually occurs when we are quite young, and once we have lived through that moment, we understand that books are a world unto themselves, and that that world is better and richer than anyone we have traveled in before. That is why we become readers. That is why we turn away from the vanities of the material world and begin to love books above all other things. Two, what I admire most about Perec is the rare combination in his work of innocence and plenitude. These qualities are almost never found together in the same writer. Cervantes had them, Swift and Poe had them. One sees flashes of them in Dickens and Kafka, perhaps in certain pages of Hawthorne and Borges. By innocence, I mean absolute purity of purpose. By plenitude, I mean absolute faith in the imagination. It is a literature characterized by effervescence, demonic laughter, joy. This is not the only experience we can have with books, but it is the fundamental experience, the one that makes all the others possible. Three. All critics mention the dazzling ingeniousness of Perec's writing, his cleverness. Much as I am awed by that cleverness, by the exuberant complexities of his brilliant mind, that is not what draws me to his work. What I am attached to is his engagement with the world, his need to tell stories, his tenderness. Underneath every trick, an Olympian puzzle. Now, Perec is the man who wrote a whole novel of 300 pages without using the letter E. All right, just to give you
a detective
an idea
story
of what he could do when he challenged. So underneath every trick, an Olympian puzzle to be found in Perec's books, there is a reservoir of human feeling, a swell of compassion, a wink of humor, an unspoken conviction that, in spite of everything, we are lucky to be alive. Restraint should never be confused with a lack of feeling. The agonizing meticulousness of W, or Le Souvenir d'Enfance, or A Memory of Childhood, for example, is the expression of a soul so wounded, a heart so shattered, that anything beyond a dry recitation of the facts would have been morally impossible. And yet, for all that, I consider it to be one of the most intimate and moving books I have read in the past 20 years. Well, this was written for a French publication. Everyone knows that Perec's parents died during World War II. He was a Polish Jew who grew up in France. Four, this is the end. In David Bellow's biography, Georges Perec, A Life in Words, an excellent book in its own right, there are several extended passages that describe Perec's life at the Moulin d'Ondé, an artist's retreat to the north of Paris. In one of them, Bellows mentions the fact that the last scene of Truffaut's film, Jules et Jim, was shot there. If one looks closely at the house in the background as the car plunges into the water, he writes, you can see, quote, the window of the room that Georges Perec would come to live and write in for most of his weekends throughout the second half of the 1960s, unquote. I was astounded to learn this. Truffaut and Perec were almost exact contemporaries. The filmmaker, born in 1932, died in 1984 at the age of 52. Perec, born in 1936, died in 1982 at the age of 46. Between them, they managed to live only as long as one old man. Of all French storytellers from that generation, the generation of men and women who were children during the war, they are the two who have meant the most to me, the ones whose work I have continued to go back to and from whom I will never stop learning. It moves me to know that they intersected in that singular and altogether improbable way. 6 years before Perec entered that room, in which he wrote a book without using the letter E, Truffaut captured it on film. Wherever they are now, I can only hope that they are talking about it. So, Perec, a wonderful writer.
And what you gravitate towards in it's a very moving passage, I must say. It's a humor. You know,
I've interrupted
it's,
you.
It's
I'm
a
sorry.
Humor. It's a humor. And when I love when Perec says, you know, I'm going to I'm going to write this text with a lot of footnotes. Not that I have anything to say in footnotes, but I love footnotes.
No. He was a remarkable writer, and I recommend them to everybody, especially the big masterpiece, Life, the User's Manual.
Yeah. But also, he has a since we're in the library, he has a fantastic essay called On the Manner and Art of Classifying One's Books.
Yes, yes.
Which ends up being completely ludicrous, because I mean, anybody who's tried to classify his books knows it's a very hard art, indeed. And he goes through so many different permutations.
Yes, whether by size, by color, by subject,
exactly. French literature has mattered to you so much, and in France, you matter so much to the French. You've had some encounters with French literature in various ways. One of them is translation. And on this very stage, I had the pleasure of speaking once with W.S. Merwin, and Merwin said that Pound had told him that the first thing he should do before doing anything else is translate. And I'm wondering what you learned from translation.
Well, I started doing this very early. It was actually, there were two influences on me early. It was the Donald Frame class I took as a freshman at Columbia, which was 19th century French poetry. And in order to understand the poems better, I started translating bits just so I could penetrate them. Then there's the other more personal factor, which is that my uncle, not a blood uncle, but the man who was married to my mother's sister for years, and who just died 1 year ago exactly, Alan Mandelbaum, was one of the most important translators we have in America. He translated Virgil, Dante, Homer, Ovid, and many contemporary Italian poets. And I mean, his Dante is the best. It's the one people read. And so Alan's example, when I was a teenager, was what set me on the course of translating poetry, not just reading it, but translating it. And so I became very immersed in this activity. And I think throughout my late teens and early 20s, I did it avidly. I worked on it as hard as I worked on my own work. And I think it was a tremendous help. Because you see, as a young writer, in many cases, unless you're Keats or Rimbaud, and I was neither one of those, you don't really know what you're doing yet. And it can be very helpful to take the pressure off of having to compose, having to come up with something new, and just lend yourself to a writer who is necessarily better than you are, and try to figure out how he's doing it. The craft of it, just the tactility of the words, manipulating language to effect, finding the cleanest, purest, most beautiful way of expressing something. This you can do as a translator. So I think it's a wonderful thing for all young writers to do. Pound, of course, didn't just advise Merwin to do this. He publicly said all young poets should translate. And I took Pound's words to heart as well. And no regrets whatsoever, I have to say.
To stay, before we go back to a few archives, to stay a little bit on the subject of some other French, not just Perec, who I think matters greatly to us both, but someone I was moved to read about, because he matters to me greatly as well, is your encounter, your most surprising encounter with Jean-Louis Trintignant.
Oh, yes.
And Jean-Louis Trintignant, who said to you...
Does everyone know who this is?
Jean-Louis Trintignant is one of the great French actors who plays in one of my favorite movies of Éric Rohmer, Ma nuit chez Maud. And you met him on a set?
No.
It wasn't on a set.
I was giving a reading.
You were giving a reading, and he would know. That's
was,
right.
He was reading
and he was
the
going
French.
To read the French, which the right. French love doing.
That's right. Bilingual and reading, and he was the
French, French reader,
the French half of it.
And you didn't know each other. You looked at each other a little bit, spoke a tiny bit to each other, and then he asked you.
Well, it's in the book.
Yeah, how old you are?
He said, "How old are you?" And at the time, I was 57, and I said, "I'm 57." And I said to him, "Well, how old are you?" And he said, "74." Yeah. He's very shy. He doesn't say much. We went back to rehearsing. And then we went into the green room of the theater where we were going to give the reading. And there were a number of people around. My publisher was there, and friends, and people I didn't know. And I wasn't saying anything. I was just sitting in a chair thinking about what I was about to do. And I saw Tintignant on the other side of the room, just looking down at the floor, cogitating about something. And then he looked up at me, caught my eye, and he said, "Paul, there's just one thing I want to tell you. When I was 57, I felt old. But now at 74, I feel much younger." Well, I didn't know what he was talking about.
Do you know?
I still don't know, but I've pondered it. I described this incident in the book. The only thing I could come up with was simply that perhaps at 57, a man is more afraid of dying than at 74, but I'm not so sure that's the answer. I don't really know. But it was so interesting and obviously meant so much to him, and he delivered it with such seriousness, and he really wanted to tell me something. And so I've been pondering it ever since. The last 8 years I've been thinking about this.
And well, so was I. I mean, I read that, and I'm not yet 57.
Right, well.
And it'll come soon enough, and I'm just wondering, what does that mean? Because it means something.
Yes, it does. It does. But I think it means perhaps that you get through the worst of your battles, and maybe you're on the other side of something, and by the time you're 74, you're liberated. And God knows this man has suffered, and said all kinds of terrible things happened to him. So it's not as though he doesn't have painful memories to deal with, but somehow he seemed lighter than most people at that age. So he had worked through whatever hell he had gone through. He was out on the other end already.
And your winter journal is also, in a way, a trip through some of the great, great difficulties, some of the hells you've experienced, some of the things
yes.
that have been particularly, that's why I thought that story was, in a way, symbolic. And more than just, well, I think that actually any anecdote you tell has some...
That's why I put it in the book.
Yeah, meaning that...
I just want to say, you see, this book is not an autobiography. It's a book of autobiographical fragments.
Sketches.
Just fragments. And I think of it as a piece of music, a literary work shaped like a piece of music.
Mm.
So it does not have a continuous narrative. It's jumping around in time. And it's not the whole story of my life. It's certain parts of my life, which I hope will create the effect of a piece of music of one sort or another. So, next question.
Next image. If we could look at images 2 and 3. Just leave that for a moment. This is cover page of...
So this is... I was in college then. It's what I had very rough, crazy handwriting. Because I am looking at the next page here. But it was written very quickly.
And the next page, I just want you to read number 33.
Number 33.
Yeah, which I find
Well, hard to read, but I can read it. Feeling estranged from language is like feeling estranged from your body. So this is the 19 or 20-year-old me saying this.
What do you think you meant?
Meaning that, you know, language is the way we experience the world, understand the world. And so it's as essential a part of our existence as it is to have a body. I think that's what I'm trying to say here. But I wouldn't hold myself to this either. I mean, this is written so many years ago, but I think that's what I was trying to talk about.
In Winter's journal, you say, "No doubt you are flawed and a wounded person, a man who has carried a wound in him from the very beginning. Why else would you have spent the whole of your adult life bleeding words onto a page?"
Why indeed?
Why?
Why? Because
I don't. Why would one?
I don't. There are no writers who spend a lifetime doing this kind of work who aren't in some way damaged. I don't think there's a single artist who isn't damaged in some way and needs to do this in order to find some way of binding up all these disparate parts of oneself. Other people are really content to live in the world. They enjoy the world. They want to be part of a group. They want to have jobs in which they're actively working with other people. And life in itself is sufficient. And I think all writers and artists of all kinds are people who don't fit in and have to try to invent things in order to create some kind of foundation for themselves on which to stand and live.
Just before you launched on a 50-year career of writing so far, you found great pleasure in sports, and you found great pleasure in baseball in particular. And
I
you
have still some, do. I
you
still do?
Do,
yeah.
Do you still play?
I don't play anymore, but I certainly follow it very closely.
Yeah, you talk about it in the book, about watching baseball whenever you can, but there's an urgency, a bodily urgency, which you describe in the book, and for myself, who knows, strictly speaking,
nothing
about the sport. I found those passages very moving, and I'd like you to read one very short one on page 35. It is marked there.
35.
That's never a dull moment.
Oh, okay. This is talking about playing baseball as a young kid. Never a dull moment, in spite of what critics of the game might think. Poised in a state of constant anticipation, ever at the ready, your mind churning with possibilities, and then the sudden explosion, the ball speeding towards you, and the urgent need to do what must be done, the quick reflexes required to perform the job, and the exquisite sensation of scooping up a ground ball hit to your left or right and making a hard, accurate throw to first. But no pleasure greater than that of hitting the ball, settling into your stance, watching the pitcher go into his windup, and to hit a ball squarely, to feel the ball making contact with the meat of the bat, the very sound of it as you followed through with your swing and saw the ball flying deep into the outfield. No, there was no feeling like it. Nothing ever came close to the exaltation of that moment. And because you became better and better at this as time went on, there were many such moments, and you live for them in a way you live for nothing else, all wrapped up in this meaningless boys' game. But that was the apex of happiness for you back then, the very best thing your body was able to do. Yeah, we're talking about 9, 10, 11, 12,
and
those
and
years.
One of the greatest memories you have of that moment is your mother and baseball.
Yes.
Your mother playing baseball.
Well, there's a long passage in this book which is about my mother, her death, her life. And there was a moment when I was 8 years old, and my mother was already then working. Was out of the house most of the time. I didn't see her so much after age six. But she had enough time to become a den mother in the Cub Scout thing that I joined that year, the only year I was ever a scout. My friends and I all wanted to be Cub Scouts for some reason. I don't think a single one of us lasted beyond the 1 year. And so she was one of the rotating den mothers, and she being the youngest and prettiest and most congenial of all the mothers, the boys really liked her a lot. And it was towards the end of the year, and we no longer wanted to do scout things. And she said, "Boys, so what do you want to do today?" We all said, "Well, let's play baseball." And we didn't have enough for two regulation teams. We were only about 12 boys or so. So she decided to play in the game. And I had never seen my mother play baseball. And it was also so ridiculous because for these den meetings, she would wear the blue den mother's uniform, which I found hilarious. You know, see my mother dressed up in this costume. So there she was in her blue den mother's costume, and she came up to the plate for the first time in the game, and she whacked a home run over the left fielder's head and ran around the bases, and it was quite extraordinary. I think the boys were so astonished.
You felt proud.
I felt very proud of her, yes. Yes, and as I say in the book, of all the memories of that time,
that's one of the strongest, one of the most. And when you were 15 or 16, excuse me for not remembering quite right, you thought you had the impression or the delusion maybe that you could become a major league player or minor league player. I can't remember which category, but I was good.
There was a possibility that if I had really pursued it, I could have been a good player. But by the time I was about 15 or 16, I began to lose interest. I discovered, well, girls, literature, cigarettes, alcohol. These things became much more interesting.
More
than
predominant.
Yes.
But you also discovered ways of entertaining yourself through writing and combining writing and baseball. And I'd like us to look, if we could, at image four from our archives, thanks to Isaac Gerwitz. I don't know what that is.
I'll tell you what
please,
it is.
Please, tell me in some detail, because I looked at them and they looked at me, and I had no idea what
I was
looking.
Okay, I'll tell you what this is.
Can you tell me?
This is all in my book, Hand to Mouth, another autobiographical book from about 15 or 16 years ago. All right, during my dark days of impoverishment, I'm talking about my late 20s, well, throughout my 20s into my early 30s, I had so little money. I had some schemes to make some cash. One of them was inventing a card baseball game. And you see these cards here.
Action baseball.
These are all made, these are hand done by me. I guess I gave them to the library. They're here.
Yeah.
And when I was a little boy, I invented a card game using a regular deck of cards. But then when I was 30, I remembered this game. I thought, maybe I can perfect it, make it more subtle and sophisticated, and make my fortune, you see. That was the whole idea. So for a couple of months, I worked out the rules. And I made a game that is two decks of cards. You turn over the cards, and things are happening. There's strategy, and it really worked out well because statistically, the games, and I played hundreds of games, would go from 1-0 to about 12-10, all within the range of real baseball games.
And did you play with someone?
I played by myself or with a friend, you know, just to test it out. I kept perfecting this thing.
And what does it mean?
Okay, so, I mean, does anyone really care that I go into this?
Just
too elaborate.
Just a little bit.
All right. Okay, there are three kinds of cars.
At least for my benefit.
All right, there are three kinds of cars. You see the red diamond in the center, the green, and the black. All right. If you're the pitcher and you're turning over the cards, a red card would be a strike. Green card is a ball. Okay, it's possible to get three strikes and an out, four balls and a walk. If you turn over a black card, that means it's a swing. And so the other player turns over his card, and then you find out what's happening. So then you go to the second level of information. So you see that card, six, red, pop out to shortstop. That would be the result. But if you turn over the third card, a single, so you get a man to first base. Not only that, if you have somebody on already, with that particular single, the runners advance two bases rather than one. I don't think we should go into this anymore. Right? But it worked out. It worked out. Yes. 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 But as I recount in the book, I never managed to sell the game.
No, and I
it was just when computer games were coming
out. No, and I must say, I saw some of the letters you both wrote to various prospective clients and the letters you received in return. So this was not the way to make.
Didn't work.
No.
Didn't work.
And you know, interestingly enough, again thanks to the Berg collection, we have some other baseball cards that I'd like
to
see.
We were looking at this.
We were looking at them, and
earlier.
I'm not sure that anybody knows about them. It's image 5. That's really interesting. Those are cards that.
There's another writer who had a much more elaborate fantasy life than I did about baseball. Jack Kerouac spent years of his life inventing leagues and players and writing about them. And this is his...
The Pontiacs.
The Philadelphia Pontiacs and the Boston Fords. On the Boston Fords, we have Pancho Villa and Red White and Phil Drayton in the outfield. It's fascinating.
And you saw some of the, we don't have that image here, but you saw actually he went through an incredible fantasy life of imagining their scores. I had the misfortune of asking you what if you knew what this meant, and you said, of course.
Yes, of course. So I think Kerouac did this for his own pleasure. I made up that game to make some money because I needed it. So it's different impulse altogether.
An image from earlier years, image 6, if we could look at that. What year is that?
I don't know. It's probably in the 80s. I think that was a picture taken at Books and Company, the bookstore that used to be on Madison Avenue.
81st or something like
79th
that.
79th Street, yeah. Maybe. Well, no, 77, right by the Whitney Museum. And there was a very nice guy who worked in the store, Peter Philbrook. And this picture is the two of us with cigars in our mouths like that. We were just horsing around.
But also there's you smoking.
Well, I've always smoked.
But you could smoke. And there's a passage in the book which is highly evocative where you say, the good old days. And you say you don't miss the good old days.
No, there were no good old days. People delude themselves into thinking, you know, things were better then than they are now.
Do they?
Yeah.
But there is something from the good old days that you truly miss.
There are things I miss, of
and
course.
And one of them
is
in
smoking
particular
anywhere.
Is smoking, yes. Anywhere.
You know, you used to be able to smoke in doctor's offices. In fact, doctors used to smoke while they were examining you. I mean, this is part of my life. It's all gone now, obliterated. You could smoke in elevators in New York City until maybe 15 years ago.
And you say quite comically that possibly it was better for our health. But a lot is lost in the process.
I feel that a lot has been lost. We've become so worried, so puritanical about everything. We need pleasure too in life, and a society that's stomping on pleasures is not a very happy one, I think.
A passage we're slowly winding down, but a passage from page 58 I'd like you to read. You were mentioning before, before when we were speaking about Montaigne, you were mentioning also Rabelais. And there's one aspect of the book that I think is incredibly important, which is catalogues, and even more than catalogues, lists. And in particular, in terms of lists, lists of places where you have lived. There are 21 different places. Actually, 21 A and B. There are 21 different places where you have lived, and you go through them meticulously, as if you are looking in some way for your body in various positions, in various spaces.
Well, you see, if this book is the story of my body, then it seemed to me perfectly legitimate to write about the places that have protected my body from the elements, my domiciles, for the same reason that it seemed legitimate to write about my mother in this book, because
she provided.
It was in her body that my body began. So there's a certain logic to everything that's here, even if it's not readily apparent.
Page 58.
58? What do you want?
Page 58 to there. It's a fairly long passage, but a good one that will get a sense of the rhythm.
Oh, okay. Your body in small rooms and large rooms, your body walking up and down stairs, your body swimming in ponds, lakes, rivers, and oceans, your body traipsing across muddy fields, your body lying in the tall grass of empty meadows, your body walking along city streets, your body laboring up hills and mountains, your body sitting down in chairs, lying down on beds, stretching out on beaches, cycling down country roads, walking through forests, pastures, and deserts, running on cinder tracks, jumping up and down on hardwood floors, standing in showers, stepping into warm baths, sitting on toilets, waiting in airports and train stations, riding up and down in elevators, squirming in the seats of cars and buses, walking through rainstorms without an umbrella, sitting in classrooms, browsing in bookstores and record shops, RIP, sitting in auditoriums, movie theaters and concert halls, dancing with girls in school gymnasiums, paddling canoes in rivers, rowing boats across lakes, eating at kitchen tables, eating at dining room tables, eating in restaurants, shopping in department stores, appliance stores, furniture stores, shoe stores, hardware stores, grocery stores, and clothing stores, standing in line for passports and driver's licenses, leaning back in chairs with your legs propped up on desks and tables as you write in notebooks, hunched over typewriters, walking through snowstorms without a hat, entering synagogues and churches, dressing and undressing in bedrooms, hotel rooms, and locker rooms, standing on escalators, lying in hospital beds, sitting on doctors' examination tables, sitting in barber's chairs and dentist's chairs, doing somersaults on the grass, standing on your head on the grass, jumping into swimming pools, walking slowly through museums, dribbling basketballs in playgrounds, throwing baseballs and footballs in public parks, feeling the different sensations of walking on wooden floors, cement floors, tile floors, and stone floors, the different sensations of putting your feet on sand, dirt, and grass, but most of all, the sensation of sidewalks, for that is how you see yourself whenever you stop to think about who you are, a man who walks, a man who has spent his life walking through the streets of cities.
What strikes me so much in this, as in the book as a whole, is language as tactile, language as touching you at a distance.
For me, it's physical. Writing is physical. Writing is very connected to music. I mentioned music before, but I think the meanings in a work of art as opposed to a newspaper article are in the rhythms, and therefore the meanings of the words convey a lot, but it's the rhythms of the sentences and the syllables that really carry the ultimate power of any literary work. And so it is tactile. It's part of the body. Language, look, I'm talking. It's coming out of my mouth. My mouth is part of my body. My lungs are engaged. My throat is engaged. It's physical. even though words are abstract things.
And the voice is utterly particular.
Everyone's voice is different. Everyone's voice is like a thumbprint. Whether on the page or in the air. Proceed.
Two last elements. There are many more images to show. I'd love to show them all, but I won't. You'll have to come to the archives to see them. There's a line from The Invention of Solitude, which I think could stand in well for Winter's Journal. It's a line by a poet I didn't know at all, named George Oppen,
yes,
who you knew well.
Very well, yes.
And it's a line on aging.
And it was a line in conversation. It's not in a poem.
But it's something he said to me. It's also included in The Invention of Solitude.
Yes,
and
yes.
It strikes me as something that this book tries to reenact in some way, which is, what a strange thing to happen to a little boy.
Well, that's what George said to me when he was about 74 or 5. Just how remarkable it was to be old. And because old people don't feel old, because you have this connection with that six-year-old self that never goes away. That internal narrative that begins at that moment in your childhood is the continuous story of who you are. And so even though we forget much, so much is obliterated from our memories, this sense of being the same person from 6 to 75, I think, is pretty universal, unless there's brain damage or some physical thing that happens. But in healthy people, you are connected to your childhood self,
and
even in old age.
You're connected, and yet you're forgetful. But I mean, so it's a mixture of
but
memory.
Even young people are forgetful. You can't listen. I can't even remember what we said at the beginning of this conversation. And this is another thing I want to say about memoirs. You know, this great genre that America keeps producing. This is not a memoir. This is a book of autobiographical fragments.
Sketches.
Because what astonishes me is that people write about their lives and they're recapitulating conversations they had or overheard when they were 6 years old, and you have 3 pages of dialogue. Now, it's not possible. These memoirs are fictions. They're making it up. And I find it so dishonest, and it annoys me so much that I want to scream when I read some of this stuff. Nobody can remember conversations, a few words from really essential conversations in the course of your life. But nobody can do it. I mean, and I
saying this was a certain amount of...
Yeah, but it's because...
Because it angers you.
It really irritates me. I mean, I can't, as I say, I can't remember what I said to you 30 minutes ago. How am I going to remember what I said to somebody 30 years ago? It's not possible. So, just remember, those books are novels. They're not really autobiographies. Yeah.
There is a moment in your book at the very end on page 220 where you speak about a dance saving your life. I'd like you, and Nina W., I'd like you to recount that moment and then read from a very early piece of yours, which I think you describe as the beginning of your writing life.
Huh. Okay, I wanted to read this thing from the book because...
You can. You can do both.
Yeah, okay.
Do both, okay. Page 220.
Because
it's
so much better in the book than what I could possibly say.
Do both.
Okay. All right.
It begins with "The dancer saved you."
So here we are. We're 10 pages from the end of the book. The dancer saved you. They are the ones who brought you back to life that evening in December 1978, who made it possible for you to experience the scalding, epiphanic moment of clarity that pushed you through a crack in the universe and allowed you to begin again. bodies in motion, bodies in space, bodies leaping and twisting through empty, unimpeded air. 8 dancers in a high school gym in Manhattan. 4 men and 4 women, all of them young. 8 dancers in their early 20s. And you sitting in the bleachers with a dozen or so acquaintances of the choreographers to watch an open rehearsal of her new piece. You had been invited by David Reed, a painter you met on the student ship that took you to Europe in 1965, now your oldest friend in New York, who had asked you to come because he was romantically involved with the choreographer, Nina W., a woman you did not know well and whose affair with David did not last long. But if you are not distorting the facts, you believe she started out as a dancer in Merce Cunningham's troupe, and now that she had turned her energies to choreography, her work bore some resemblance to Cunningham's, muscular, spontaneous, unpredictable. It was the darkest moment of your life. You were 31 years old. Your first marriage had just cracked apart. You had an 18-month-old son and no regular job, no money to speak of, grinding out your meager, inadequate living as a freelance translator, author of 3 small books of poetry with at most 100 readers in the world, padding your pittance of an income by writing critical pieces for Harper's, the New York Review of Books, and other magazines. And apart from a pseudonymous detective novel you had written the previous summer in an effort to generate some cash, which still had no publisher, your work had staggered to a halt. You were stuck and confused. You had not written a poem in more than a year, and you were slowly coming to the realization that you would never be able to write again. Such was the spot you were in that winter evening more than 32 years ago, it's almost 34 years ago now, when you walked into the high school gym to watch the open rehearsal of Nina W.'s work in progress. You knew nothing about dance, still know nothing about dance, but you have always responded to it with a soaring inner happiness whenever you see it done well. And as you took your seat next to David, you had no idea what to expect, since at that point Nina W.'s work was unknown to you. She stood on the gym floor and explained to the tiny audience that the rehearsal would be divided into 2 alternating parts: demonstrations of the principal movements of the piece by the dancers and verbal commentary from her. Then she stepped aside and the dancers began to move around the floor. The first thing that struck you was that there was no musical accompaniment. The possibility had never occurred to you, dancing to silence rather than to music. For music had always seemed essential to dance, inseparable from dance, not only because it sets the rhythm and speed of the performance, but because it establishes an emotional tone for the spectator, giving a narrative coherence to that which otherwise would be entirely abstract. But in this case, the dancers' bodies were responsible for establishing the rhythm and tone of the piece. And once you began to settle into it, you found the absence of music wholly invigorating, since the dancers were hearing the music in their heads, the rhythms in their heads, hearing what could not be heard. And because these 8 young people were good dancers, in fact, excellent dancers, it wasn't long before you began to hear those rhythms in your head as well. No sounds then, except the sounds of bare feet thumping against the wooden floor of the gym. You can't remember the details of their movements, but in your mind you see jumping and spinning, falling and sliding, arms waving and arms dropping to the floor, legs kicking out and running forward, bodies touching and then not touching. And you were impressed by the grace and athleticism of the dancers. The mere sight of their bodies in motion seemed to be carrying you to some unexplored place within yourself. And little by little you felt something lift inside you, felt joy rising through your body and up into your head, a physical joy that was also of the mind, a mounting joy that spread and continued to spread through every part of you. Then, after 6 or 7 minutes, the dancers stopped. Nina W. stepped forward to explain to the audience what they had just witnessed. And the more she talked, the more earnestly and passionately she tried to articulate the movements and patterns of the dance, the less you understood what she was saying. It wasn't because she was using technical terms that were unfamiliar to you. It was the more fundamental fact that her words were utterly useless, inadequate to the task of describing the wordless performance you had just seen, for no words could convey the fullness and brute physicality of what the dancers had done. Then she stepped aside and the dancers began to move again, immediately filling you with the same joy you had felt before they'd stopped. 5 or 6 minutes later, they stopped again, and once more Nina W. came forward to speak, again failing to capture 1/100th part of the beauty you had just seen. And back and forth it went for the next hour, the dancers taking turns with the choreographer, bodies in motion followed by words, beauty followed by meaningless noise, joy followed by boredom. And at a certain point, something began to open inside you. You found yourself falling through the rift between world and word, the chasm that divides human life from our capacity to understand or express the truth of human life. And for reasons that still confound you, this sudden fall through the empty, unbounded air filled you with a sensation of freedom and happiness. And by the time the performance was over, you were no longer blocked, no longer burdened by the doubts that had been weighing down on you for the past year. You returned to your house in Dutchess County, to the downstairs workroom where you had been sleeping since the end of your marriage. And the next day you began to write. For 3 weeks you worked on a text of no definable genre, neither a poem nor a prose narrative, attempting to describe what you had seen and felt as you'd watched the dancers dance and the choreographer talk in that high school gym in Manhattan, writing many pages to begin with and then boiling them down to 8 pages, the first work of your second incarnation as a writer, the bridge to everything you have written in the years since then. And you remember finishing during a snowstorm late one Saturday night, 2 o'clock in the morning, the only person awake in the silent house. And the terrible thing about that night, the thing that continues to haunt you, is that just as you were finishing your piece, which you eventually called White Spaces, your father was dying in the arms of his girlfriend. The ghoulish trigonometry of fate. Just as you were coming back to life, your father's life was coming to an end. So, well,
space, what you're trying to work out there in some way or another, is the space that exists between what we experience and what we express. And yet, in some way, the necessity to find words that fail us.
The words failed. The words failed so miserably that for some reason, and I say it still confounds me, it opened up room for me to breathe in again, room in which to start writing again. And I suppose until that moment, I had always thought words could do it. And then I realized that night that words can't do it.
You know, at this hour, I'm wondering if we should read this whole 8 pages.
We can't. It's too late.
But maybe I could read the first few lines and you could read the very last ones.
All right.
Something happens, and this is indeed from White Spaces, written in 1979. Something happens, and from the moment it begins to happen, nothing can ever be the same again. Something happens, or else something does not happen. A body moves, or else it does not move. And it moves, something begins to happen. And even if it does not move, something begins to happen. It comes from my voice, but that does not mean these words will ever be what happens. It comes and goes. If I happen to be speaking at this moment, it is only, I hope, to find a way of going along, of running parallel to everything else that is going along, and to begin to find a way of filling the silence without breaking it. And then I'd love you to read from there to the very end.
All right. Okay, so this is the piece written end of 78 into the early days of January 79.
And which got you to writing.
Yeah. Well, here we go. Okay. And then we'll end the evening with this. So this is towards the end of White Spaces. In the beginning, I wanted to speak of arms and legs, of jumping up and down, of bodies tumbling and spinning, of enormous journeys through space, of cities, of deserts, of mountain ranges stretching farther than the eye can see. Little by little, however, as these words began to impose themselves on me, the things I wanted to do seemed finally to be of no importance. Reluctantly, I abandoned all my witty stories, all my adventures of faraway places, and began slowly and painfully to empty my mind. Now, emptiness is all that remains, a space, no matter how small, in which whatever is happening can be allowed to happen. And no matter how small, each and every possibility remains, even emotion reduced to an apparent absence of motion. Emotion, for example, as minimal as breathing itself, the motion the body makes when inhaling and exhaling air. In a book I once read by Peter Freuchen, the famous Arctic explorer, describes being trapped by a blizzard in northern Greenland. Alone, his supplies dwindling, he decided to build an igloo and wait out the storm. Many days passed. Afraid, above all, that he would be attacked by wolves, for he heard them prowling hungrily on the roof of his igloo, he would periodically step outside and sing at the top of his lungs in order to frighten them away. But the wind was blowing fiercely, and no matter how hard he sang, the only thing he could hear was the wind. If this was a serious problem, however, the problem of the igloo was itself much greater, for Freuchen began to notice that the walls of his little shelter were gradually closing in on him. Because of the particular weather conditions outside, his breath was literally freezing to the walls. And with each breath, the walls became that much thicker. The igloo became that much smaller, until eventually there was almost no room left for his body. It is surely a frightening thing to imagine breathing yourself into a coffin of ice. And to my mind, considerably more compelling than, say, The Pit and the Pendulum by Poe. For in this case, it is the man himself who is the agent of his own destruction. And further, the instrument of that destruction is the very thing he needs to keep himself alive. For surely a man cannot live if he does not breathe. But at the same time, he will not live if he does breathe. Curiously, I do not remember how Freuchen managed to escape his predicament. But needless to say, he did escape. The title of the book, if I recall, is Arctic Adventure. It has been out of print for many years. Nothing happens, and still it is not nothing. To invoke things that have never happened is noble. But how much sweeter to remain in the realm of the naked eye. It comes down to this, that everything should count, that everything should be part of it, even the things I do not or cannot understand. The desire, for example, to destroy everything I have written so far, not from any revulsion at the inadequacy of these words, although that remains a distinct possibility, but rather from the need to remind myself at each moment that things do not have to happen this way, that there is always another way, neither better nor worse, in which things might take shape. I realize in the end that I am probably powerless to affect the outcome of even the least thing that happens, but nevertheless, and in spite of myself, as if in an act of blind faith, I want to assume full responsibility. And therefore, this desire, this overwhelming need to take these papers and scatter them across the room, or else to go on, or else to begin again, or else to go on, as if each moment were the beginning, as if each word were the beginning of another silence, another word more silent than the last. A few scraps of paper, a last cigarette before turning in, the snow falling endlessly in the winter night, to remain in the realm of the naked eye, as happy as I am at this moment. And if this is too much to ask, then to be granted the memory of it, a way of returning to it in the darkness of the night that will surely engulf me again. Never to be anywhere but here. And the immense journey through space that continues. Everywhere, as if each place were here. And the snow falling endlessly in the winter night.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you. That was wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you. Paul Auster.